Hello, ramblers and gamblers. Josh Rosenthal here. Thanks for rating, subscribing, reviewing IG at Rambling and Gambling, and the old email, ramblingandgamblingpodcast@gmail.com. Two interviews today. First up, James Alberino, stud pro bettor, founder of Spread Investor. We're going to preview the NBA Finals with James. Then our old buddy Rufus Peabody is back. We're going to talk to Rufus about hedging, when you should do it, whether the concept is a little bit different for recreational bettors versus sharps. And, you know, we'll just BS with Rufus a little bit too, which I personally very much enjoy. Here we go. Let's get things started with James Alberino. James, you know how long we've been talking about doing this? This is sad. It's very sad. You and I had a phone call in November. I'm not sure if you remember. At the time, my Wizards were in the process of starting the season 10-3. Your Knicks were off to a decent start as well, and they just come off making the playoffs the year before. And we were like, yeah, let's do a segment about which of these up-and-coming teams is better, the Wizards or the Knicks. And here we are now. Lots changed in 6 months, huh?
Well, 6 months, that feels like it was three seasons ago, and I'm glad we didn't do that because we would have a lot of takes on that podcast that we would listen back to and just say, what were we thinking? Those first 2 months were fun. I think there's talent on both teams, but just the way that the organizations were going, coaching and –
Yeah. Let's not start. You're going to put me in a bad mood right off the top, James. Let's talk about the two teams that still have a shot. The two squads that are still in this. We're recording this Tuesday afternoon. As of right now, FanDuel has the Warriors as -160 favorites for the series. Celtics are +130 to take it. James, who do you have winning this and why?
I have the Warriors by the slimmest of margins. I think experience is one thing that will favor the Warriors, and the Celtics. I'm sorry, man. My phone.
That's fine. Just keep going. Let me tell you something. This podcast, we are laid back, my man. And I'll be lucky, by the way, if my kid doesn't start screaming at some point during this. So don't worry about the phone. Take it away. Keep on rolling. Warriors. You like the Warriors?
I think the experience edge, you know, one thing with the Celtics is they still haven't, as you've seen during the playoffs, is figured out how to win after a good performance. So can they string together versus the Warriors two wins in a row? They're going to be on the road for game one. I think game one is a tough spot for them. And, you know, coming off an emotional game seven series, I feel like this is – it's going to come down to a game where can the Celtics sustain their three-point shots enough to string together two wins in a row. I don't know if they can do that, especially with how much the Warriors switched up their defenses and showed a bunch of different styles versus Dallas. But there's slim margins on both sides. This is one of those finals out of the last couple of years where – I don't think that there's that much margin for error on either side.
Yeah, I'd agree with you. Are there any individual matchups that you're really going to be paying close attention to, especially at the start of the series?
Well, the Celtics have advantages when the Warriors are in man. The Celtics are going to go at Steph Curry and Poole whenever he's in as much as possible. But that's why I think you're going to see more zone from Golden State to avoid that. Golden State didn't show a lot of their zone until really that Maverick series. They waited. They finished the first two series. I think Steve Kerr knows that if he lets Curry and Poole get isolated in pick and rolls, that it will eventually wear down on Golden State. I'm looking forward to the Marcus Smart Steph Curry matchup because yeah. I think Smart is going to get as physical as he can with Steph Curry. That's what Boston's mentality has to be coming into this series is you don't want to play as much finesse basketball with Golden State. You want to take advantage of the physicality that you have over them. Marcus Smart being one of them, Robert Williams being another. You know, Looney was a big piece in the Dallas series, but that's because there's no one like Robert Williams in that series. This is very different for him. Looney had a 20-point game in Dallas. I don't think that's going to be the case versus Robert Williams. Celtics are really going to have to resort to bully ball in a couple of these games.
You mentioned game one, which is something I wanted to ask you about. I will sometimes basically blindly just bet against whatever team is coming off of a game seven win under the assumption that they might be kind of gassed. So that worked for me twice in the last round. I bet against the Celtics in game one against the Heat, won that. I also bet against the Mavericks in game one against the Warriors and won that. Does that strategy make any sense to you here? And I guess I will point out one major difference is they've got more rest in between games this series than they did last time around.
The Warriors are going to have a full 7 days off between game five versus the Mavs and game one in this series. I think that I don't think that helps them as much as in the prior series where, like, when Boston came off that seven-game series versus Milwaukee, they had to fly to Miami and play less than 48 hours later. That's really tough. You might see a little bit of rust from Golden State with that. You know, Kerr has said, he said a couple of times over the years, the sweet spot for Golden State in terms of rest versus rust, they like those 4 days off, maybe 5 days at most. So 7 days is going to be interesting. That said, I like always playing the urgency factor of game one at home. If you lose game one at home, you're setting yourself up. You're in a big hole. A lot of people don't talk about it being a do or die because it doesn't make sense to talk about a game one do or die. But if you think about it, you lose game one at home, you're chasing the entire time. You lose home court advantage, you're down 0-1, and now you're at best, you're going on the road tied 1-1 with the potential of being down 3-1 if you don't steal a game. So I like that urgency factor. And with the way that this line opened up for this series, -3.5, you know, the spread has not come into play a lot at all these playoffs. And with it might take a little bit for Golden State to get going in the first and second quarter, but with the Warriors, with the way they play the third quarter, I could see this being a close game at half. Maybe the Celtics with momentum and not too much rest from the Celtics probably have an advantage in terms of the proper amount of rest if you're looking at both teams. But I think that the Warriors can have that third quarter tidal wave where they go on a run. And that will be the key in this series is can Golden State rev up their engine for one of those third quarter runs, because we've seen Boston have lapses, and I think that's going to be a key for the start of the series.
That's an interesting take that you have there with Golden State actually potentially having too much rest. I hadn't considered that. I was mostly thinking about Boston not having enough after that seven game series, but that makes a lot of sense. Let me throw the stat out there, James. Not that this should necessarily impact the way anybody bets this one, game one or whatever. I just thought it was really interesting. Comes from Zach Cram of The Ringer. He wrote that since Steve Kerr took over as the Warriors coach, they've gone just 7-9, the Warriors have, against the Celtics. And actually, Boston is the only team, the one and only team during Kerr's tenure that has a winning record against the Warriors. Again, may not impact anything now, but I would have guessed that at least a couple teams would have had winning records against the Warriors with Kerr as coach, but they don't. It's just Boston.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I think, you know, Tatum's a tough matchup for them. The Warriors are used, you know, you're not used to playing 6'10" guys that could shoot the way that he does. You know, it is a very, very tough matchup. Golden State's going to have to be unique with their approach. I think Kerr's going to have to throw a type of defense that surprises Boston. Yeah, but that is surprising. I wonder how many of those games, all those games would be in the regular season. Yeah, I'm curious as to how many of those games were within the last 2 years. You know, the Warriors did have that stretch in 2019 and 2020 where they weren't great, and the Celtics might have benefited from that. But, yeah, it all goes back to our point that there's not much margin for error, and there's advantages on both sides.
I've got one on that season where the Warriors weren't great. Actually, hold on. I wrote it down. Just another one. I thought, oh, yeah, okay. Per ESPN stats and info, in 2019-20, this is what you're referencing, the Warriors finished with the worst record in the NBA, the worst record in the league, and they're the first team to go from the worst record in the NBA to a finals appearance within a three-season span since 64-67, when, interestingly, it was the Warriors that did it too. You do not see this very often. And granted, the Warriors, I mean, they had it. They were already a good team with some very big-time injuries, but thought that was interesting since you bring it up. Let me ask you this, James. You know, we cater to very casual recreational bettors on this podcast. Do you have any advice for listeners on what types of bets to make during this finals? For instance, some guys like to bet the series or individual games or player props or a combination of all of the above. Is there an overall strategy that you would recommend casual bettors apply?
I think if you recommend something just generically and a macro approach, it could get dangerous, because I believe that every series is its own individual puzzle. You'll see both teams playing a different style than in other series per se. But I will say this, and this is something I'm always interested in, but you have to wait till later in the series. I think when you get to that game 5, 6, and 7 point, if there is a game 7, I will automatically look for player prop point unders, because the games tighten up and you're going to have, if you have a guy early in the series who's hot, what's the adjustment going to be from the opposing coach? Okay, we got to throw more doubles at him. We got to throw more traps at him. We have to maybe switch up a defense and throw a zone at this point. So if you see a guy going off for 25, 30 points, I think later in the series, you're going to want to favor a more defensive approach. Even look at game 7, Miami and Boston. That game was flying over for three quarters of that game. And then game 4, fourth quarter, came to a standstill. There were hardly any scoring, and it ended up going under by a point and a half. So I think when the game slows down in general in the fourth quarter, you're getting more half-court possessions, you're getting less transition. I definitely would look to favor defense later in the series.
That's a really good call. I did something similar in the Dallas series. In the last two games, I took the Luka under for points for that very reason, because his props were getting up to like 35 points a game. And I get it, everybody wants to bet the Luka over, but there is a lot of value as the series goes on the under.
And think about it if you're just a new bettor. What are the books want to do in this case? They know that there's only one basketball game on right now. All the attention from the public is on that. They're going to inflate the stars' point values because that's what everybody wants to bet on. They want to focus on a couple of key players, but that's where you can actually get value, is fading that inflation.
Speaking of stars, here are the odds for finals MVP. Steph is the favorite, +105. Tatum, +180. Jaylen Brown, 10-1. Klay and Draymond, both 14-1. Jordan Poole, 36. Smart, 38. Wiggins, 41. Al Horford, 120-1. You see any value there with any of those guys?
I like taking a stab at Klay, 14-15-1 on Golden State side. And I like Smart. I don't know what the odds you said was, but I saw he was up to +4,500 at one book.
38 as of today, Tuesday, on FanDuel, but you might be able to get him elsewhere.
Look, yeah. If the Celtics win, it's more likely than not going to be Tatum that wins them the series and probably gets it. Do you want to bet MVP at those short of odds? No. If you're looking to go on a ride with a guy that has a chance, I think Klay and Smart are probably the two best guys. Klay had 32 points and 30 points in the closeout games versus Dallas and Memphis. He's always one of those guys that if he sees one or two threes go in, he could get on fire. And I think this is going to be a really emotional series for him because of the way that the finals went for him a couple of years ago, and then he had to sit out. And if there's that much attention on Steph Curry, the other two guys, I think Klay and then also Wiggins, I think, is worth a ticket too, a 25-1, because he's going to see a little bit less attention than Steph and some of the other guys. Wiggins was great in the last series. Wiggins had 18 points per game in the last series. Game 3 in Dallas, he was the best player on the court. You wouldn't think that. So again, not a great chance of him winning MVP, but a 25-1, that's a good ticket. And then I think Smart, for the reasons I was saying before, I think he's going to try to go at Steph Curry. He's the best defensive player on Boston. And at a great ticket at 45-1 or 38-1, whatever you could get it at, great odds.
Yeah, Wiggins was 41-1 as of this morning on FanDuel. I see what you're saying. And to your point, remember, Curry's never won one before. So that worries me a little bit, because I could see voters saying we got to get one to Curry. But at the same time, we've seen before, with all that attention on Curry, it does open stuff up for other guys.
And Wiggins is a different player than he was 2 years ago. He is not the same guy. When he was in Minnesota, a lot of inconsistency. He's actually a guy that you can go to and rely on for offense consistently at this point. So it's going to be very interesting to see how Golden State's offense looks with that much attention on Steph.
I will say this. You don't see a lot of non-superstars win this award. I went back and looked, and I don't know, maybe Clay, the first guy you mentioned, qualifies as a superstar. But Andre Iguodala won it in 2015. Otherwise, here are the winners, starting with last year, going back to 2010. Giannis, LeBron, Kawhi, Durant, LeBron, Iggy in 2015, Kawhi, LeBron, Dirk, Kobe. It's a superstar award.
Yep.
Let's say the Warriors do end up winning this all. I want to talk big picture with you for a minute. They've got a pretty interesting case here to be included among the short list of true NBA dynasties. Here's the breakdown. With a win, the Warriors will have won their fourth title since 2015, and they've already made it to their sixth finals in 8 years, which nobody's done since MJ's Bulls. Now, you compare that to some of the other recent runs, James. You got MJ's Bulls won six titles between 91 and 98. Kobe Lakers and Shaq Lakers, for some of it, won five between 2000 and 2010. Duncan Spurs won five championships between 99 and 14. LeBron himself has four championships on three different teams. And then, you know, of course, you've got, Magic's Lakers and Bird Celtics, so on and so forth. James, if the Warriors win this one, where do you slot them? How do you think we'll remember this team?
It's rare territory to put them in with MJ and the Bulls of the 90s. But if they get back on that track, look, in terms of aesthetics and how they look on the court, this is the most entertaining dynasty out of probably all of them, just with different style of play, more three-pointers. I think if Kobe and Shaq would have been together for a little bit longer, we could have made the case for that. With the way that they're going, like, what's so unique about this team is that they're not just so reliant. Like, the Bulls were – MJ had to go off in every single game for the Bulls to win their title and go on their run. And Pippen was more of the defensive guy and facilitate the offense. You know, he's good for 20 points, but he's not going off. Steph and Clay with two of those guys, and then you have another guy off the bench – who can score 25 on you in a game as well. I'm not ready to put them above Jordan and the Bulls, because that was just such an era of dominance. And it's hard to compare, because it's two completely different styles of basketball. Talking 25 years later, I would put them probably somewhere. Yeah, Shaq and Kobe, there was dominance there. That's the difference when we're getting on this subject. You had dominance with Shaq and Kobe, dominance with Jordan on the Bulls. This is more of a finesse. We're just going to shoot a whole bunch of threes and probably put up a 35-40-point quarter on you at least once in a game that we play in and beat you up. I'm not ready to put them ahead of MJ and the Bulls.
Maybe I wouldn't either. There. It's an interesting thought exercise, especially if they win this. But I wouldn't put him over Jordan and the Bulls either. I mean, Jordan and the Bulls won 6 and 8 years, obviously. Right now, though, I'm thinking that I might slot them near the Spurs, which is a team that I have a ton of respect for. And the styles that they play, especially the later year Spurs, are somewhat similar. It is a little bit more of a finesse game there. So, I don't know. Something to keep an eye on. I'm sure if the Warriors win this, this is going to be all sports radio is talking about for a few days there, right? I've got some other non-finals NBA stuff for you, man. But before we do that, any other finals bets, angles, anything that you want to hit?
I think if you're going to bet this series, it's worth looking into the correct score. Eight of the last 12 finals have gone at least six games. So if you're betting, you know, Warriors in seven, Celtics in six or seven, I don't see how the series goes five or less. I believe the Celtics, if you took the Celtics in seven, it's plus 650, which is a great ticket. Game six would be in Boston. And I think Boston had – I think playing in Boston for game six versus Miami hurt them more than it helped them. I think that pressure of closing it out on your home court when you're such a young team and you know, they're not great at stringing two wins together to begin with. So I think playing into this series, if there is a game six in Boston, I would lean towards the Warriors winning that game and the Celtics having to finish it in seven. So Celtics in seven plus 650. And then you got the Warriors also in six plus 550. Both of those tickets will be alive. And let's say you get to game seven with the Celtics at plus 650. You're going to have the Warriors most likely around minus 3.5, minus 4, which is what they're at right now, because the lines don't change that much from game to game in the playoffs. So you could be sitting there with a plus 650 ticket and a pretty inexpensive price on the Warriors money line and set yourself up where even if you do bet the Warriors on the money line in that game, you could lock in profit on both sides either way.
That's really smart. I you've just convinced me. I did before having this conversation, I never would have played that, but now I'm like, oh, that's really smart. And that's why we're inviting you on the pod, man. That's a good one.
Figure plus 650 and then the money line for game one would be about for game seven would be about minus 170. So you have nice arbitrage there between 170 and 650 to make money.
Yeah, I like that a lot. I like that a lot. Our next interview on this podcast is about hedging, by the way. So that's we're not ready to move on from you yet, but that was a nice little would have been a seg. Nice one there, James. All right, couple things around the league. What's going on with that other New York team, man? New York Daily News reported the Nets are unwilling to give Kyrie a long-term deal and that Durant hasn't talked to team management at all this offseason. I know you're based in Vegas now, but you're a New York guy. What's going on with the Nets?
Yeah, the Nets, if you were following that series closely with the Celtics, there was just so much heavy drama going into it. And you know, watching the press conferences, Kevin Durant before game four when they got closed out was saying, you know, that there's been so much going on this season. We've had to deal with a lot. He was talking so much in a reflective tone of what they've been through for 6 months. And can you blame him? You had to deal with Kyrie playing half the games, then Kyrie calling out James Harden, then having to bring in Ben Simmons. When Ben Simmons came onto that team, it was so laughable that people thought the Nets still had a chance to win the finals this year, because like you're going from one malcontent to another, bringing in Ben Simmons. And if you're KD, you're looking at this and saying, man, I've got to deal with one dude who can't stand the media, who just wants to be on his own agenda. And then another guy who, I don't really care. I want to be careful with how I put this with Ben Simmons, because who knows what's true and what's not. I'm very cognizant and sensitive to the fact of mental health being a big factor, not just in athletes, but in life in general. But in his case, he hasn't been clear on that the entire time. It's been a lot of just brushing off the situation that happened in Philly and deflecting and just not dealing with things head on. And if you're a max player, if you're a superstar, you got to deal with that stuff. So regardless of what's affecting Ben Simmons, you have to look at this from Kevin Durant and saying, Kevin Durant's on the back nine of his career. Kevin Durant isn't going to commit long-term and doesn't want to be there long-term if he has guys that he can't rely on. So the Nets franchise is definitely in a mess. And I know someone who worked within the Nets organization prior to this year and is elsewhere within the NBA. And it just seems like the timing was right to just get out through the back door, because who knows what's going on with this franchise now.
Do people in New York care? I mean, they're definitely not the Knicks. How much do you think people care in New York about this drama?
Oh, they don't. And I was at the Knicks-Nets game in November, the one where the Knicks lost by two. There was a controversial call at the end. It was a heavy Knicks crowd. The Nets, in terms of marketing and sales, they have to go outside of the box, and they invite different corporations, and they have different kids' nights on very frequent occasions that you don't see at Madison Square Garden. There was a point where when Harden was on the team, they were doing a buy one, get one half off ticket deal during the regular season. And it's like, all right, if you're a 500 team, okay, but you got Kevin Durant, you have superstars on this team, you shouldn't be out begging for ticket sales. So no, it's nowhere near. Even with the Knicks not even being good, you just have that passion from the Knicks fan base that isn't even there with the Nets. And what's funny is you have kids outside of the Garden that are 18 and 20 years old who weren't even born in the 90s when the Knicks were good. They've never seen an ounce of relevant New York basketball up until the last year and a half. And those kids are really into it, which tells me, okay, they're getting it from their fathers and that fan base. And everything about the sentiment of the 90s has trickled down to this generation. So if the 18 and 20-year-old kids aren't fans of the Nets, then their fan base is nowhere near in a position to rival the Knicks.
Here's the last real question I have for you. I guess it's not a fake question, but it's a ridiculous question. You'll see why. Last real question. Here are the current odds to go number one overall in the draft. Again, it's FanDuel. They have Jabari as a -220 favorite to go to Orlando. Chet, 2-1 to go first overall. And then next up, Paolo's all the way down to 13-1. You playing any of these? Seeing any value there?
You know, the NBA draft, I don't play too heavily because a lot of the information, a lot of the key line movements are happening during the NBA playoffs. And I'm honestly too locked into the playoffs for me to be on top of the draft. I feel like the lines have moved to a point where, you know, maybe with a little bit of homework between now and then, I find something for a later pick. But the first three picks, I mean, those guys, you're not going to find much value in the beginning. And I feel like even though Paolo is the better player than Jabari and more ready for the NBA right now, the Magic needs somebody that is a game changer. Jabari Smith's upside is so high that even if he has some work to do cerebrally on the game, his talent level's so high.
Yeah, he's such a good shooting big. I mean, he shot like 42% from three or something like that, and he's 6'10". That's tough to pass up. Okay, here's the very last one. James, you know, we started the pod laughing at ourselves, talking about the Wizards and the Knicks. Well, have you looked at the odds for the Wizards and the Knicks to win it all in 22-23? You have any idea what these are?
I have other things, better things to do with my time than look up.
Well, luckily I do not. Your Knicks are 200-1 to win it all. My Wiz 300-1 to win it all. And judging by those numbers, man, I'm thinking it might be another long season for both of us.
It probably is. You know, Julius Randle. Look, the Knicks have a really great core. That's what the disappointing thing is that the Knicks have a really, really good core and a lot of guys who want to be there, that those type of guys that play and dive on the floor for the 50-50 balls. Julius Randle has become a malcontent. I've seen it firsthand where this guy has just melted under the pressure of expectations. And if you're that personality, you can't fit in New York City. It's just not going to work. There's a certain personality that you have to have if you're going to play in the Garden. And he's not. That's why he did so well in 2020 going into 2021. There weren't fans in the stands for most of those games.
You think Randall's still with the team next season?
I don't think so. I don't. I think there are conversations being had. I think difficult conversations because there's such a price tag to him. But I think what the Knicks might have to settle on is trading him away and getting something of lesser value to avoid drama in the locker room, because he did become a malcontent when the fans were turning on him, and when the whole dynamic of his relationship with Thibodeau not being the same and the standards were different from the rest of the team, that's a problem within the organization. I'd rather build this team around RJ Barrett. And, you know, they're talking about moving Mitch Robinson, which would be disappointing because I think he's a great piece for the team. Randall has to go.
RJ looked good this year. I didn't expect it. I thought he looked very good this year.
He looked great. And you know what the funny thing is too? If the Knicks end up keeping Randall, this is what I fear. The expectations now are so low that it favors this guy. He does well when people don't expect much from him. There's no pressure. So then he might have a bounce back. And then if the Knicks are in any sort of limelight again, what's going to happen to him?
Yeah. I've got a hunch. James, where can listeners find you, man? Plug away. Give it all to us.
You can follow me on Twitter, my business account, Spread Investor, and I just try to post as many stats and information and picks as I can. Yeah, NBA is most of my focus. I handicap a lot of college basketball when that time comes. After the NBA finals, I'll slow down a bit. But you'll catch it. Actually, the summer league, I'll have picks for. This sounds crazy, especially if there's a lot of casual bettors. The NBA summer league is a great time to make money, Josh, because the books are not paying attention to it. And for the guys that are just starting to bet, just a general rule of thumb: if there is a league, if there is a tournament, if there is a sport that is not highly publicized, it's not much on TV, those are actually where you can find a lot of advantages, because the sports books, the odds makers don't care as much. They don't have that much liability on those leagues. So if you're following it closely, which I will be out in Vegas, it's at the Thomas and Mack Center out here. If you have a team that's trying to set a tone going into the regular season, and you could watch a game or two of them, you could ride them for pretty much the entire summer league, and the numbers usually don't catch up.
That's an interesting one. That's a lot like what we've heard from a bunch of sharps on NFL preseason. Good time to make money.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Look, NFL preseason is a great time to make money. You could watch press conferences of NFL head coaches and get a really, really good feel for what their intentions are. Some coaches really play to win, and they want to set the precedent of playing competitive ball. And then other teams are in more of a tryout phase. Hey, let's sample with this lineup. Let's sample with that lineup. It's usually when you have – you can't really call them a veteran, more of the veteran team. NBA Summer League, that's not as prevalent, but let's say a veteran Summer League team, where let's say you have guys that are in year three playing against more rookies and second year guys. That year three team might want to set a tone, and yeah, they're definitely the better side to look at.
I like it. Like it a lot. Making me think of Andre Blatt, who played with the Wizards summer league team forever and just roasted younger guys and then did his usual thing all regular season long. James has been great, man. James Alberino, Spread Investor, clearly an elite basketball mind. Thanks for coming on, dude. Glad we can make this work.
I appreciate it, man. This was fun. Thanks for having me.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is now my distinct pleasure to welcome back the pride of Alexandria, Virginia, Rufus Peabody. You hated that intro, didn't you?
No. I was raised. I wasn't born. I was raised in Alexandria, Virginia.
The pride, nonetheless. Sorry. What did I say? You're born? No, I said the pride of Alexandria, Virginia, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Whatever. Good to have you back, man. How you been?
Pretty good. How about you?
I'm good. Are you coming to us from your Vegas compound? Never know where you are. Where are you right now?
No, I've been in Vegas for a while. I'm actually in Denver right now. I'm visiting a friend and on my way east. So I'm actually going to be in DC this weekend.
Oh, well, I would say that you and I should meet up, but I'm actually leaving. I'm leaving DC this weekend. One of these days, man, I'd love to meet up in person. That'd be really cool.
We'll figure it out.
All right. So let's talk hedging. I was really happy to see you tackling this issue because I've been talking a lot about hedging lately with my little gambling circle. Reason being, a lot of us had NBA playoff futures that may have been worth a hedge, but it is kind of confusing figuring out how to do it. So, for instance, I had Heat to win the Eastern Conference ticket. I bet him at 5-1 before the playoffs started. That's a pretty easy one to hedge, especially when she gets a, you know, game 7 against Boston. But just because you can hedge it doesn't mean you should hedge it. And I think this new tool that you came up with for Unabated, you know, takes a lot of the guessing game out of it.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I think people think normally in terms of maximizing their expected value of a bet or a series of bets. So just the amount of profit you make or you're expected to make rather than sort of the expected bankroll growth, which is something called, I mean, the Kelly criterion. I don't know if you've heard of that. I'm not going to nerd out over that. But I mean, basically it says what you should be maximizing is how much you grow your bankroll, which you could think of it as like growing your wealth. I mean, like if I gave you 100-1 odds on a coin flip, you would clearly want to bet that.
Right.
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 And you want to bet it for a good amount, but you wouldn't want to put your entire net worth and mortgage your house on it because you could lose.
Right.
And if you kept playing that game, eventually you'd go bankrupt. But, you know, if you think of it in terms of expected value, every dollar you're not putting on that is like, you know, you're throwing away expected value. So, so basically the hedging calculator uses that to sort of guide your decisions, your expected bankroll growth. And obviously we're probably going to get into bankroll and all that in a second, but
we are here. Let's start this way. I wanted to, cause this is a really good story. I want to talk about why you started down this path. So you had tweeted, a picture of a monster PGA championship ticket that you lost in heartbreaking fashion. Basically, just a couple weeks ago, you had Mito Pereira. Apologies if I'm not pronouncing that one right. It continues to flummox me. You had Mito to win it. You were risking $500 to win $150,000. $150,000 on a $500 bet. And Mito has the lead. He's on 18. And then he double bogeys it. So you tweet a picture of this ticket and then take it from there. How did the calculator come about?
Well, that was just one of my tickets on him, actually, unfortunately, but it kind of sparked a discussion about hedging on Twitter, a Twitter thread. And it got me thinking, maybe it might be worth it to actually sort of build something here. And I kind of put something together, something someone wrote actually sort of sparked a thought. Like I was like, oh, I could easily just put, you know, I could sort of solve this. I had to kind of look back at some old calculus stuff. Well, by that I mean Google, how do you differentiate logarithms basically again. But I kind of was able to sort of solve for what your optimal hedge should be, conditional on knowing your bankroll, how much you stand to win from your initial bet, the probability of it winning, and what odds you're offered on a hedge. And so we kind of were able to put that together in basically 24 hours. Me and Matt Snyder, who's the head of engineering at Unabated, and he was able to actually productionize that super, super quick, which was, I think, really cool, just that we could turn it around while this was still going on, sort of, it was still in the news cycle, if you will.
Yeah. You know what? I'm sorry to interrupt you. I saw you tweet about the hedge calculator before I saw your tweets about Mito and the whole conversation. So I thought this was something that had been in the works at Unabated for a long time. I had no idea that you basically pulled this together over a weekend. That's really cool.
It was one day actually. So,
well, let's do this. Let's start big picture. So you can input all that stuff. The tool, I should mention, is free for anybody on unabated.com. What's been the response since you've had the tool up there and people have been able to hedge?
Oh, I think it's been overwhelmingly positive. I mean, I think both from sort of the sharp community and I think the more recreational people that have used it. I mean, I think the issue for people, and I think especially recreational bettors, though, is just going to be defining what your bankroll is. And so I think some feedback has been, oh, this makes more sense if you're a sharp bettor, for sure, than it does if you're a recreational bettor. I don't think that's necessarily the case, but I think it can be harder, as you know, harder to sort of figure out what your bankroll is. That I think that's the biggest thing. And
I wanted to ask you about that. You know, we do this podcast for recreational bettors predominantly. I'm very much a recreational bettor. I'm not a sharp, as everybody who listens to this knows. I don't really have a bankroll, because if I'm betting between like 20 and 50 bucks a bet, like I heard you on your podcast on the Bet the Process pod, talk about the bankroll being for a recreational bettor. I believe you said basically it's just what you are willing to lose before you would not buy back in again. I just don't have that number, because I'm betting such small amounts of money anyway. I know there is a number there, but thankfully I don't lose, I guess, that much.
I think I'm actually kind of, I'm wrong in that actually. I kind of want to take that back.
Okay.
Because if you, let's say you have someone that's like very wealthy, but you know, is betting small and, you know, it wouldn't be like they have let's say they have a $50 bet that stands to win $50,000, but they're, you know, a multimillionaire or something. And that 50,000 isn't going to materially change their life in any way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's mm-hmm. a small percentage of what their net worth is. And so for me, I mean, the way I think of my bankroll is generally sort of my semi-liquid net worth, but I don't have it defined exactly. But so I think in that way, like whether someone should hedge or not there depends on, it honestly is more about their financial situation overall.
Yeah.
Rather than sort of a betting specific bankroll. I think what's hard though is that, you know, so Kelly Criterion, which this is based off of, is basically saying you want to maximize your bankroll growth, but a recreational bettor, Kelly will basically always for any bet say bet $0 on it if you don't have an edge.
Right.
So it becomes hard, I guess, to say, and I guess this is sort of tangential, but how much, like what is considered responsible staking for a recreational bettor? Like I can say what it is if you have an edge based on what your edge is, but I don't know, you know, responsible staking, like optimal staking is $0 if you don't have an edge, but you know, unless on a standalone bet.
Right.
But yeah, so I think it's an interesting discussion of what is, you know, how should a recreational bettor be staking then? And like, how did you decide on your, I mean, I don't know if you win or not, but you said you're recreational. So
yeah,
I assume recreational means like sort of maybe you break even, win a little bit, lose a little bit. I don't know.
Yeah. So I call myself a recreational bettor mostly because of the process as to how I come up with my bets and the fact that I bet small amounts of money. I am a winner, a long time winner, okay, but not by much. So I'm very close to break even. I do know that for a fact. And so for me personally, in many of these situations, for instance, let's use the heat ticket that I had as an example, even though I could have very easily hedged, the ticket I had on the Heat to win the Eastern Conference, I chose not to. I let it ride just because it was more fun for me. Honestly, I ended up losing the ticket altogether, as opposed to if I had hedged, it would have been pretty easy to just negate my losses.
Right. So when you started betting, were you winning initially?
No, not initially. I started very young, and I was losing more than I was winning. Doing this podcast has helped me be more of a winning bettor, honestly.
When you started, how did you decide how much to wager on a, you know,
so bet? Okay, so when I started, I was very young. I spent a lot of time at this barbershop where there are a lot of guys that bet, and they allowed me to bet through their bookie. This was like pre-internet. And so I had to come up with 50 bucks a pop, because that was the minimum to put anything down with this guy. And I was literally like spending bar mitzvah money on gambling, and I lost the first couple, and I never gave up my fascination with it, but that is when I tried to get smarter about it.
Okay, so I guess what I was trying to get at though is like how does a recreational, like how does someone that maybe doesn't expect to win like decide and is doing this for fun decide to how much to bet?
I don't know. I mean, what I do and what I recommend people do is bet up to the point that if you lose, it won't ruin the rest of your day. And that I think varies person to person. So for me, oftentimes I'll throw 20 bucks on something because if I lose, I can keep on going, have a good day. Whereas more money than that, sometimes I'd be ticked off and it would affect me.
Okay, that makes sense.
So that's what I do. Let me come at it this way, Rufus. Just in general, for somebody who's casual like me, do you have a stance on whether the hedging calculator is a good thing? I mean, I think it's a good thing to play with no matter what. I feel like I've learned a lot just playing with it, and it's kind of fun. Or do you think just in general, if you're betting these kinds of small amounts of money, maybe hedging just isn't for you because it's more fun not to?
No, I mean, so in a way, I've kind of, you know, as I said, I've kind of revised my stance a little bit since I said your bankroll should be, your bankroll for the purposes of the hedging calculator should be like, in a way, what your wealth is, like, because that's what should affect the decision, right? Mm-hmm. Like your betting might even be just entertainment money, but like suddenly if you have a financial decision that could like, you know, materially impact you, that's, you know, that's when hedging potentially comes into play. And that's when you should actually consider your, I think your wealth overall to be your bankroll.
That makes sense.
Because it, right, it goes from a recreational entertainment decision to actually a financial decision that could meaningfully impact you.
Yeah.
And so yes, I think it's, I think the calculator in that way is still extremely useful, maybe even more so.
I like that. That makes a ton of sense. And I definitely do, you know, sometimes I'll have a ticket where I stand to win quite a bit of money, or sometimes I do like, you know, tread into deeper waters because I feel really good about something, and the hedging would definitely be a good move at that point. Let me ask you, your buddy, Captain Jack, who does Unabated with you, was he anti-hedging at one point? What did he think of the whole calculator?
I mean, I was sort of anti-hedging at one point too, but maybe not as militantly as he was. Uh-huh. I think when I suggested a hedging calculator, he said that, you know, it would be one response, no. but I think it's just so ingrained in the minds of people that do this for a living to not take negative EV bets, basically, that it's kind of a hard thing to, stance to sort of change, I guess.
Because if you're hedging, almost always it's a minus EV bet. That's,
yeah. I mean, so if you can hedge at neutral EV without sacrificing any expected value, you should always hedge the full amount, like make it so that you have absolutely no decision. You stand to, your bankroll will be the exact same whether you win or you lose the original bet. So, because, you know, that way you're realizing your expected value and your expected growth is going to equal your expected value in a way in that regard. So you keep the same expected value and you minimize your variance, which is like the dream.
Yeah.
But
one more for you. I saw you tweet, I think yesterday, that you had an opportunity to use your hedging calculator. What was the scenario there? Can you walk us through that one?
Oh yeah. So I had bet on Sam Burns for the PGA event. I hadn't bet him before the tournament, but I actually bet him was able to get some each way stuff at 200-1 after the second round. And then I got a bet on him at FanDuel at 280-1 after round three. He was pretty far back, but there was the weather was a lot more benign and forecast to be a lot more benign for earlier tee time. So it seemed it was one of those situations where people that were further back had more of a chance than in a normal event. He actually like posted, I think 5 under for his round. And then all the guys at the top kind of faltered and he ended up tied for the lead and with Scottie Scheffler, and it went to a playoff. And so I was like, you know, should I hedge this? Right. I never would have thought about hedging it before, but like there's a gap, you know, there's, you know, a 10 minute break between Scheffler finishing his round and the playoff starting. And so I don't make live numbers, so I don't actually know what the true probability was. I think you could get minus 125 on Scheffler. I assume the number would be somewhere in the, like, I mean, it's close to a coin flip, like 51% Scheffler maybe. Because it's sudden death one hole. And so, but given how much I had to win, hedging was not the right move for me.
Didn't hedge. And how did that one work out? How did that play out?
Burns won.
Nice.
So yeah.
Nice. I know I'm really early on this and didn't prep you on it at all. But we have been talking more about golf here this summer, especially with the majors. Anything that you're eyeing with what's the next one? U.S. Open, right? Is the next golf major this coming month in June?
It is. I haven't really started my prep for it yet. But yeah. Back to hedging for one sec. I think what's interesting for me is, so for me, I guess given what my bankroll is and what I stood to win, hedging becomes much more of a, like, I'm very unlikely to show hedging is the right move unless it's at very, very small negative EV. You know, maybe if I could have gotten a hedge at like, you know, if it was negative 0.1% EV, you know, that suddenly, you know, might be an option. But it's, so it's going to be very sensitive to the expected value of the hedge. Whereas if you stand to win a lot relative to your bankroll, that is where EV plays a less significant role. You're not price sensitive at all at that point. You know, it's entirely about your bankroll. And so, you're going to basically want to hedge regardless. So, you know, if I had $10,000 to my name and I had that Meetup Pereira ticket and I could have won $150,000, I'm hedging fully no matter what price you offer me within reason, I guess, even if I'm hedging at like a negative 15% ROI on that one bet. So
I do really like that your tool incorporates bankroll. I think it kind of has to, and I've seen other hedging calculators that I've used in the past and ultimately stopped using. In part, I think, because they don't factor that in. And I think it does change a lot as far as whether you should hedge or not, your own, personal situation money-wise.
Yeah. It's predicated on this, on essentially the fact that you're trying to maximize your wealth. And so.
Last one I have for you, Rufus. Mito, double bogeying on 18. You have a chance to win an astronomical amount of money. Is that the worst gambling loss you've ever had? Not money wise, but emotionally.
Emotionally, no, not even close. In terms of this was a very big swing just because it was a major and I was able to get so much down. Like, we had to win about 300,000 on Mito. And Kyle Stanley blew a 3-stroke lead on the final hole of the 2012 Farmers Insurance Open at Torrey Pines when he was in the fair, like the easiest hole in the course. He was in the fairway 100 yards out and two also, like, and all he had to do was make a double bogey on that hole, right? And he made a triple bogey. So like that was probably the most tilting. I didn't stand to win as much as I did for on the Mito bet, but certainly emotionally that was much rougher. I think just having done this as long as I have, I'm able to sort of get over the disappointment a lot quicker and just keep a more even keel.
You seem like a pretty
not too
even
high,
kill.
Not too low.
Yeah, you seem like a pretty even kill person just in general. So it's good stuff, man. It's important if you're going to be a pro better. That's for sure. Rufus, plug away, dude. Where can people find you? What else do you have cooking on Unabated, the pod, anything, any of the above?
Well, we have a lot cooking at Unabated, but I think first off, go to unabated.com. The hedging calculator is free. You do need to sign up, but sign up for the free version.
It's fun to play with.
Join the Discord community. We have a really great community on Discord. I'm amazed at how, and Captain Jack has done a fantastic job of building that community. It's not toxic at all. And I know that gambling Twitter can be very toxic. It's actually people like kind of helping each other out, and it's very intelligent discourse. And so I'm really proud of that. We have a lot of tools in the works. Our NFL simulator is back again, although I believe that's behind the paywall at this point, which allows you to simulate the season, and it integrates with an odd screen, so you can basically find value shopping for futures bets for the NFL. You can also, I guess, you can find me on Twitter at Rufus Peabody, and I have a podcast that I co-host with Jeff Ma of the movie 21 fame called Bet the Process.
I'm still waiting for you to stick it to Jeff one of these days. He's so hard on you, Rufus. He's so hard on you, man.
That's, you know, if I wanted someone to just agree with everything I was saying, I wouldn't have, you know, I wouldn't host a podcast with Jeff Ma, right? Like,
no, I know. And honestly, the banter back and forth is absolutely one of the reasons that I keep on listening. And Rufus, thank you very much for coming back on. Also, please say hello to our buddy, Captain Jack, who was the very first guest that we ever had on the Rambling and Gambling podcast. I've got to reach out to him and see if we can get him back soon. Captain Jack's amazing. So thank you very much, Rufus Peabody, unabated.com. I still say pride of Alexandria, Virginia, whether he was born here or not, even though he doesn't agree with me. Thanks for coming on, my man.
Thank you for having me, Josh.
There it is, ladies and gents. Thanks to James and Rufus. We'll be back next Wednesday. I'm going to go on a little end of the week vacay here, hitting the beach. Looking very forward to that. Hope everybody else is getting some time away this summer too. It will be normal schedule next week, though. It's just like a long weekend that I'm spending at the beach. Have a few guests tentatively lined up for next week. They're not super firm commitments yet, so I don't want to put any names out there just in case, but we've got a good shot at that being a very good pod. We'll see. Fingers crossed. Yeah, that's pretty much the deal. I don't know. I'm loving the summer. I'm loving barbecues. I'm loving betting. I'm dreading like having to bet on baseball, I guess, here soon when NBA wraps up. But, you know, just happy. I like the sunshine. The sunshine's got me in a really good mood these days. What can I tell you? Thanks for rating, subscribing, reviewing. IG at Rambling and Gambling. Email RamblingAndGamblingPodcast@gmail.com. Everybody, have a great week.